Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, teaching Americans to persuade Americans, because it seems like we might need that these days. We're coming at you from the intersection of politics, rhetoric, and comedy. Found a more obscure intersection than that, people. Politics, rhetoric, and comedy. Those are my worlds. You can find us on social media. I tweet jokes all day long at Rhetoric War on Twitter. Also go to rhetoricwarriors.com. You can take our one-year master course in persuasion. You get a module each week that's going to make you a master persuader. That's the offer. I'm Dr. Dan French, rhetoric PhD, escaped professor, used to be hanging around universities, can't do it anymore. Also stand-up comedian, comedy writer from late night in Hollywood. The podcast is designed for three purposes. I bring on right-wingers, Trump voters, and I convert them. That's fun. I talk to comedians about their politics, and I find persuasion pros to tell you all the secrets of influence to magically take people from where they are to where you want them to be, because that's what the game is in persuasion. My guest this week, I think, is a blend. I think he has there's a lot of pro ideas in this guy. Just about production and life and getting things to acceptable message level. And he's also a comedian, so this is going to be a good double guest. I'm going to just real quick give you a little bit of background on Eddie Feldman. I know Eddie because he was my head writer at the Dennis Miller show on CNBC. He's been around, I don't know, how many shows? I looked on your LinkedIn bio, and there's like 20 shows listed.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's true.
You've been doing this a long time.
I will not dispute that. I'd like it to be 21 next
21.
Year.
Well, 21, you know, yeah. There's always the next show.
Yeah, so, that's right.
Universal showrunner, great comedy guy, five-time Emmy winner. Everybody welcome, Eddie Feldman. Eddie.
Nice to be here. I'm good. Very good. Good to see you, Dan.
He also lives in paradise, and he taunts me with that all the time.
Just because I am able in a short drive to see water upsets Dan, knowing that I have an escape route somewhere.
I think you're underselling what you can have a short drive to actually see. It's not just like water. It's not a puddle. It's bridges.
It's the view of San Francisco skyline, the bay. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, you live in postcard land.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and in fact, my Christmas card was something I took and then built together on Keynote this year, which was good.
So run your background just a little bit. You started as a stand-up in New York, is that right?
Well, actually, my first career working in my parents' delicatessen in the Hudson Valley.
That's really?
I got a lot of, yes, many skills there. Of being in front of people, and it was called Eddie's Delicatessen. So my name was up in lights since I was one. So I wanted to pursue that. So that's how I started in front of people and got, I look back and kind of got comfortable because I was, hey, waiting on people and talking to them. And,
who came through delis.
Yeah.
Jeff Appeloff? Right.
I do. I know who he is. Yes.
Family was in the deli business.
Oh, I'll have to, I didn't realize that. So I have to compare. So yeah, so I started there. From there, I went in, I have a degree in criminal justice. So I used to work with delinquent kids and a caseworker and then emotionally disturbed kids. And that was a natural, Drew Carey said after that, it was a lateral move into comedy from working with emotionally disturbed kids, which is true.
Yeah, because I know,
well, you know what? We used to give these people meds and now they're headlining shows with the same problems. So,
and still taking meds.
And still taking meds. Yeah. No, although not prescribed. And, you know, and then, yeah. So then I got into stand up after I talked my way into getting laid off from my social services job so that I could go back and forth from where I was living up in Northampton, Massachusetts to New York City. To audition, you know, at the comedy clubs.
Cool. So you talked your way out of that just by being a comedian. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know what? It's happened a few times in my life where I get called into an office where I know like you're going to get fired, but they don't know, it's social services, so they don't know how to do that. So I basically had to tell them, I go, well, it sounds like what you need to do is you can't afford me, so you need to lay me off and you know, get someone for less money. And they're like, yeah, that's what we need to do. I'm like, okay, let's go.
So you, that's a good employee, self-firing yourself. That's
I was like, well, I don't want to do this anymore, and I can, you know, I can make some money in unemployment and then pursue my next option, because I realized at some point, like, okay, I don't know where social work is going to lead me, so let me get into something even more destructive. Stand up. I don't know where that's going, but you know, I had a window to give it a try.
It's funny. There are, you know, overlaps in those two careers, right? Like I was married to a marriage and family therapist for 10 years. And, you know, I told her at some point, this was when I was writing for Best Damn Sports Show and Tom Arnold was, you know, the talent. And she was running a really, like a support group for really old Jews, survivors of the Holocaust. And I'm like, we are literally the mask of comedy and tragedy right now.
Yeah.
You know, same materials, but just completely different directions.
You know what? I really do credit my two earliest job experiences working in my parents' deli, organized, very, you know, you have to be prepared for the lunch rushes, which I always looked at as like, okay, that's a show. You have to get ready. And then dealing with very entertaining yet odd people of emotionally disturbed kids. Was really dealing with fellow comedians and you know, other people in the show business. So that was it was awesome. A good beat. Yeah.
Do you know Jason Galern, comic there in LA? You ever met Jason?
No, I don't. No.
He has a second career and he's done it forever, where he teaches, LA has a second school system basically for the gang members and, you know, all the problem kids. Yeah. There's so many of them that they really run two school systems, and he's taught in the second one for a long time. And just great stories about, you know, a full, you know, class full of the kids of gang members, and, you know, the way they approach education, very different than the way the mainstream approaches education.
Yeah, no, there's a good, you learn as much as you teach when you're working with kids that have been, are in this, as they say, in the system.
In the system.
In the system.
Aren't we all in the system?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some way.
So, okay. So I got in, started doing stand-up in New York.
Yeah. So actually, what was weird was, you know, I kind of got introduced to it when I was in Massachusetts. There was a comedy club just outside of UMass. And some friends said, hey, there's this thing, stand-up comedy, want to go? And so we went to the show. And funny, because people I work with later, Ken Ober's show.
Okay.
He was still going to UMass. And so he was running this comedy club, and I was like, I told him later, I go, after seeing you, I realized like, oh, I could do that. It was very helpful to see you. And then, so these people had friends that were doing in Norfolk, Virginia, had like a comedy sketch troupe. And I met them and they're like, hey, you know, after my friend's wedding, because remember I was laid off, why don't you come down and hang out and we'll go to the beach for a couple. And I'm like, okay. So I went down to Virginia, and on the way they said, there's this new comedy club in Virginia Beach opening up. Why don't you give it a try? So I went up like an open mic night, did really well. And the guy who ran it said, hey, if you're down here, I'll give you your own Tuesday night, you know, run open mic night. You can have
really?
All the time you want. Yeah. And I'm like, okay. Huh. So I kind of, for that summer, went down to the Virginia Beach Comedy Club, and they also had the Richmond Comedy Club. And I started to work that circuit, and people always thought I was from Virginia just because that's where a lot of the comedians would work and they'd meet me. So they're like, well, you're from Virginia. I go, no, it's just for the summer. And, you know, yeah. So that's where I got a lot of stage time, and then went back up to New York. And I was like, okay, now I had a little experience under my belt, and I could kind of hit the New York clubs again.
Interesting. I did the Virginia Beach circuit. It's probably not the same people.
Oh, you did?
There was a Thurgood Inn. Do you remember that? Do you ever?
Thurgood Inn. Yep. Yeah, that's what. Yeah, that's the one. Mike, the guy, was the owner of that. And
there was a guy, Dane, guy. Wasn't he? Like he was a Navy SEAL that owned that place at one point.
He, There could have been. Yeah, I mean, Mike was the first, you know, because it wasn't a Howard Johnson's. That's where it first opened. And then after Howard Johnson's, it moved to the Thurgood Inn, this place, and that guy, Mike, ran it. April Pascarella was the booking agent. April ran the Richmond Comedy Club and Virginia Beach Comedy Club, and her cousin, Rick Cheeks, who was newly out of prison, ran the Virginia Beach Comedy Club. My experience with delinquent kids came in handy, because they're now I used to go with, when he visited his parole officer, I would come along
on something there for comedy training.
Yeah. So really it was like, get in with the mob guy. That's really the lesson.
Yeah, you've got to be able to deal with some of that element, like, you know, especially back in the 80s when comedy was just everywhere and, you know, it took nothing to open up a club and make it work. Everybody came in and ran a club. So you were going to run into everything, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you did. You definitely, depending where you went. And at that time, you know, you never knew, like, okay, what was this before? You know, last week it was this. This week we're doing comedy. And you're like, okay, all right, whatever. Get paid, right?
you can tell like a real stand-up, because that's that phrase of, okay, yeah, whatever. You know, that's the pro stand-up. It's like, you got a microphone, right? And I get paid.
Yeah, no, I remember, you know, there's times when you're like, they bring you into a room and you're like, okay, where's the stage? Like, oh, we don't have a stage. You just stand on this step. And then there's a dim light, and then you're in a microphone and people are walking by you and they're like, who's that guy? And you're like, yeah. And they're like, hey, I wonder why it didn't go well. It's like, they don't know there's a show. It's usually a rule of show business.
Yeah.
Make sure the audience knows why they're there.
Yeah. You should turn off the TVs during the set. That's, I remember giving out that advice once. Well, but it's the World Series, you know, they like, well, then you shouldn't be scheduling comedy during the World Series. Right.
Yeah, I just saw a YouTube video. I was looking at for who is it? Leslie West just passed away from Mountain, you know, and so I actually was like, oh yeah, and looked him up on YouTube. And funny, he popped up, and then there was like underneath it there was this 21-year-old blues guitarist from New Orleans named Kingfish, and I'm like, I checked him out. And he's amazing, but they have the YouTube performance is sure enough at some club, and then there's a New Orleans game on the background. They're like, yeah, we're not giving that up. So I was like, oh, I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you better be a good blues guitarist. You're going to call yourself Kingfish and play in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. He's 21. He's like this unbelievable. I would look him up. He does this rendition of Hey Joe that, you know, he's old beyond his years. He's great.
Yeah, sounds like it. Again, if you're going to take on Hey Joe, you better be able to play the guitar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll send it to you when we're done.
Okay, cool. So let's move you into a more current day. So you, I've known you as a showrunner forever. So tell us about how you got into that career, because I think it, you know, my stuff is about rhetoric, which is designed persuasion, right? So it's all about...
Yep.
How much more effective you are if you actually know how to put things together before the moment they occur, you know, and that's your job. That's your whole universe, right?
Well, your job is, and this has happened a few times in show business, and I've said it, where you know more than your boss. So you basically have an intern for a boss, because one day you're explaining to them how things work. And the next day they give you notes on what you've explained to them. So I've had that several times. So yeah.
People haven't come through a creative show structure. They've just been imposed on top of it.
Well, and also because, you know, talk shows late night, when you watch the great ones, it looks pretty easy, but also there's not an infrastructure. Whereas a sitcom, you know, is like, okay, we start with a premise, we write a script, we agree on the script, we cast it, we look, we rewrite it, we shoot it, we edit it. For a late night show or a talk show type of thing, it's more like somebody pulls up in an empty lot and dumps off every material you need for a house, but with no directions. And your job is like, hey, you have 6 weeks, we need the house. And then that's what you need to do. It's like, well, what, where is it? It's like, I don't know. You just, there's your guy, let's go. So what happens is the executive whose job it is to supervise, but it yet has no background in it, just throws things at the wall, and you're persuaded, you have to persuade them, persuasion, that you know what you're doing, and then persuade them that they know what they're doing. So it's a twofold sort of job. It's like, wow, you know, I've used this before, but told it many times, is like when you're building a set, because you're like, okay, that shouldn't be hard, you're doing it. But I've learned that on my set, my talk show set, I always bring out a really ugly chair for the host. And so I set it all up and there, that. And then because the executive's coming and they're like, well, I have to give a note, but I don't know. And it's like, well, that chair is really ugly. I go, oh, you don't think it fits? You go, no, I don't know. It doesn't really fit. I go, well, you know, I have some other ones in the back. Why don't you take a look and see if you have it? And then they can go back and pick out the good chair, which we were going to use. And then that's their note. They give the note and it's like, yeah, you're right. This is much better. They're happy. And we can move on with the rest of the show.
Now that to me is master level, you know, production. That right there is like when you're producing at that level, like we used to do this thing with Tom Arnold. We would close every show with five things you wouldn't say to some professional athlete. Right. And so he had to reject, you know, the first bat. So you just send the shitty ones first to let him reject them. And then you would send the second ones and he'd feel like a genius because he was holding out until they were great. You know?
Right. And I'm not the only one. I've talked to another showrunner on other projects, and she was just doing, getting notes. And so her thing that she said was like, you know what? I always make sure I give them some stuff that I know they're not going to like, because otherwise, you know, and then hold off on that. So I'm not the only one, you know.
That's a pro tip, right? That's real.
Yeah, it is. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, don't give them everything all at once, because they have to give some sort of note. And it's not that they're going to give a bad note, but, you know, if they have another note, that's good. They might have a great note. But this one, you're like, at least they got one.
Interesting. So take us through your producing career. How did you get into that? And you're most well-known, I think, still for Dennis Miller Live on HBO. You guys won 5 Emmys for it. You know, that to me was the show that was the political show really before, you know, The Daily Show and all that kind of stuff. I think you guys were the precursor of a lot of that. But take us through your production career, like getting into the industry and, that kind of.
Sure. Well, so how I first got my writing job was I had met Dennis really the first night he auditioned for Letterman at Catch a Rising Star. We didn't know each other. I was at the bar and he was like, said to me, he goes, hey, are you a comic? I'm like, yeah. He goes, hey, I'm auditioning for Letterman tonight. Can you come in and watch? I'd like to know how you think I did. I'm like, yeah, sure.
Really?
So I went in, it was like unbelievable. It was great. 5-6 minutes and came out and he was like, well, what do you think? I go, hey, I'd give you the show. It was unbelievable. Great. He goes, yeah, I thought I did really well and things. So I hadn't, you know, that's when I first met him. I didn't see him again till after Saturday Night Live. And, we ended up, somebody booked me. He had a couple of colleges and they were like, hey, do you want to open for Dennis? I'm like, yeah, I met him a long time ago. So we did a couple of those dates. We really hit it off as friends and he liked, you know, what I was doing. I was pretty clean, you know, and I set him up well.
Your wire is hitting your zipper there.
Oh,
there you go. That's what
stupid.
That is.
Yeah, see, you're producing me. That's what's going on. Sorry. Let me know if I think I fixed it. But so anyway, he said to me while we're working at this college, he's like, he goes, you know, I have this late night show coming up because I have all my writers. But if you want, I'll pay you and you can send stuff in every day from New York. And I'm like, yeah, because I was pretty busy then with stand up and doing a bunch of colleges. So I did that. And like, I was noticing it like in 2 weeks ago, hey, I seem to get quite a bit of stuff on. And then I was in Buffalo and I got a call and they're like, hey, one of the writers isn't working out. Can you be out here to work on the show? I'm like, yeah. I go, when do you need me? He goes, Monday. And it was like Saturday. I'm like, okay. So I literally flew out there and I had no, I never worked on a TV show. Did that 6 months. That show got canceled. And then did a couple more
was
things with him.
Was that his show on, was it Network? Was that a that Network
was,
show?
It was a Tribune. It was syndicated.
Okay.
They were trying to do, you know, was he going to be the, that's when they're looking for the next Johnny Carson.
Sure. Yeah.
And yeah. And it was like, okay, well, if you knew Dennis, it wasn't seem like he's that, it's completely different. Okay. Not the Midwestern sensibilities or, you know. Okay.
Right.
And then, you know, after 6 months, that show got canceled. And I did some other things with him. I did some other shows. And then all of a sudden he's like, hey, I have some interest from HBO. And I was like, well, you know what, maybe you need to do like a half hour show and make it more to your strengths. And you don't have the third. And he's like, yeah, that's what they're talking about. So he goes, would you be, you know, I'd like you to be the head writer for it. I'm like, okay, great.
Okay.
You know, yeah, that was pretty, you know, I was only in LA for a couple of years. So I was the head writer. And then really because of that and how we kind of put it together, you know, my next promotion after the first season was as a producer. And then as a producer, I won my first Emmy and the first Emmy ever awarded, you know, to a cable show. So it was like my first producing job, my first
nice.
Emmy. I had already won for my first head writing job, a number of Emmys. So it's like, well, this is pretty good. Let's keep this going. So really, but the producer stuff, which then led to more things was, you know, Dennis hired a lot. He's always hired great writers on this first show, you know, that show for Tribune. You know, the writers, you know, two of them wrote Space Jam the Santa Claus. Two wrote, you know, created Will and Grace. One created the 70s show. One, Paul Blart. I mean, you know, it's like your show of shows. So he had a great eye for talent. And the second show, I kind of brought more, instead of stand-ups, which he favored, stand-ups, but writer stand-ups.
Right.
People who were more like, hey, these are really good writers. That's what they want to be. They don't want to necessarily always be the star of the show. They're okay. So I kind of rejiggered it and a little bit with as some of the other writers left. And I think that made a difference because it just kind of moved it up to the next level. And then producing wise, well, I went back to the old Deli and Emotion Disturbed kids and was like, okay, we have, it was organizational. It was like deadlines. He was only really coming in one day a week because he was up in Montecito. So I had to coordinate how we got material to him, how we picked it, how we edited it, how we put it together. And that's really kind of started the producer stuff because it was more than, hey, I sit in a room and write jokes. It was like, well, I got to do that, but also responsible for that show every week. And the booking parts of it and overseeing that and really supervising the writing as well.
Yeah, so and that's pretty rare, right? I mean, those have both sides of the brain to be able to do that. You know, a lot of comedians, like I'm working with somebody right now and she's hilarious. She's great. But talking to her, I thought it's like talking to 36 raccoons on cocaine. I'm like, yeah. You know, get one of the more stable raccoons up here to talk to me for a minute, you know, because it's great, but it's useless. You know,
well, yeah. I mean, you got to realize that in stand-up, stand-ups have picked really the profession where they literally have distanced themselves from their audience and work 1 hour a night, and that's their. And so getting them in a situation where no, now you have a staff of people, you're doing all this sort of stuff. Yeah, this isn't just you come in. You need to look at material, you need to pick these things. We have promotional stuff. Yeah, that's where I think the disconnect between stand-up and late night or comedy host is that, you know, who's able to handle that sort of workload.
And stand-up's bad training for Hollywood. I mean, because it makes you too reliant upon yourself, right? And you're used to making very easy decisions about your own material and you're not used to breaking things open to groups and it's bad training.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I remember meeting George Carlin and talking to him about stand-up, and his line, which was perfect, was, you know, it's a tough job, but I like the hour. And I was like, that's the thing. And it's like, yeah. So, you know, he was, you know, obviously brilliant, but yeah, it's not just a, hey, I have an 8:30 spot. So I come in at 8:25 at the Improv and then I go home. It's like, well, no, you're kind of responsible for building the building, who else is on the show, promoting the show at the end of the show and greeting people. And if you're, you know, not that guy, I mean, that's why the HBO show for Dennis was perfect, because one guest, it really played to his strengths. And really that kind of template, as you say, then went on, because then the Chris Rock did that, you know, his version of it. Even now with John Oliver, it's like, hey, it's a once a week prime time, you know, show where you do the best. And that's how we kind of, it was beneficial that I worked on that strip show, the first one, because really for the writers on that HBO show, what we did was we wrote it every day like we had a show that night. And then put all the best of together for that one half hour. That's really, whereas sometimes people are like, it's Tuesday, we don't need to write anything. The show's not till Friday, you know?
Yeah, when you look at, you know, and people don't see the, again, this is, again, with my background in rhetoric, you don't see everything behind really well-designed messaging. You know, you just see it at the point when it works and you're like, wow, that's great. But all the stuff going on behind it, like with a show, you guys got to cook that material for a whole week, you know, and it's a half hour. Like the rants, you know, clearly are the most artistic opening, you know, monologue pieces. And I would say in, I don't know, television history, has anybody ever done anything that got to that level of art, you know, with comedy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way they were sort of put together was also, you know, that didn't really exist before. So because Dennis was doing more of that type of longer sort of comedy piece, you know, in his act, really gave strength to like, hey, why don't we figure out how we do that, you know, once a week on one single topic. And so the way that was written was that there'd be a topic, and then the writers would just go off and write whatever they wanted. And then I would get the material to Dennis. He would pick out what he liked, but with no beginning, middle, and end. And then I would take it and kind of like, okay, let's formulate this, you know, cut it down. And what started at 40 pages, you know, eventually got down to a page and a half. So in order to get that, you know, really honed and that sort of thing, that was really, I think, the first time that, you know, anybody had done that. I would imagine like with John Oliver and some of the other people, it's kind of getting closer to that, but though they've been using more images, ours was just straight to camera, you know, look right in the face of the viewer and deliver the material.
Yeah, that was amazing. Like, I remember watching that and thinking, you know, there's no support there. Like, Dennis is a, you know, fascinating talent to be able to flow things out the way he does verbally. And, you know, at that point in his career was so facile with, you know, the densest language and everything else. And you could write it to the level of somebody else couldn't even just say this, you know, and he would just flow it out verbally. And it was just a perfect union of that very dense script, very architectured script, and somebody who could handle it, you know?
Well, and also what people don't realize is, handle it. The first time he ever read it aloud was the first time he did it live. He never read it aloud. He didn't practice it. He would, in rehearsal, he would have another writer read it and he would sit there and listen to it. But it wasn't like okay. Cause after that rehearsal, then we go back and rewrite it and work on it. It would go into the teleprompter and he was able to deliver it like it was so natural. He always said, that's my little trick. He goes, if I couldn't do that, I wouldn't have a career. And it's like, no, you're right. Cause we've tried it with other people. And if it's stilted or they can't do it, it doesn't work. It doesn't have that free flow of, almost like a boxer, you know, hitting a bag that he was able to do.
You know, and I think, you know, when we wrote together, or when you were the head writer at the CNBC version of Dennis's show, you know, we did one of those, what was it, Cut to the Chase? A little mini rant, but it was every day. You know, there were some great writers on that show, and you could feel it, but you could always feel like, it's half cooked. Like, it's still, there's good stuff in there, but it's not what you guys did at HBO.
Well, yeah, because you had that week to do it, and, you know, you had, one of those things where it's like, if we only did it once a week, but that's the difference of a strip show or a premium cable or streaming show. It's just, it was a different makeup, and that's not what they ordered.
Well, and people ask me now, like Dennis went through his, conversion phase of being, I think sort of the darling of the left in a lot of ways, and then moving over and, becoming the non-darling of the left, or, I'm not exactly sure how to positioning him. But you were there through both of that. And like the challenge of doing political comedy, when you're talking to sort of the liberal audience, it makes sense to TV. When you're starting to talk to the non-liberal audience, the politics don't make as much sense to TV. And I remember getting a lot of blowback about that, about Dennis's politics while we did the show. What do you think about that? Like, you've worked a lot in political comedy. Was that what you were doing before you got into this? Or is just, you'll shape any of the material? It doesn't particularly matter what the social bent of it is.
Oh, what my background? Yeah. Personally, you mean is?
Was that the comedy that you're drawn to? Like, you just do comedy, right? You're not.
But I remember one time, and it's just before the CNBC show started, we all went, myself and Dennis and Mike Murphy, who worked on the show and is a political pundit, and went to Washington. And so we went to the Capitol, and we met with some Republican senators at the time. And they were like, why doesn't Hollywood like us? Why are they making, it's like, and afterwards when we got done, I didn't say this to their face, was like, it's like, because comedy works, you take down the big dog. It's a David and Goliath. If Goliath kills David, it's not funny. If David kills Goliath, it's like, he did. So really, and if you look at Republicans, that's really where they have been. They've always been wealthy. So it's harder. And so I think Dennis, what he was trying to do was just, hey, I'm not going to do Bush jokes. And it's like, okay, but you're missing out on a whole genre that people expect of you. So your shift, for whatever reason, it just leaves more of a hole than, there are plenty of other topics. And it wasn't like with Trump where it's like, hey, if you didn't do it, it'd be funny because it's like now, like, okay, no Trump jokes. Like, so, okay, then what? What are we, right. Now right. What? Yeah, because that's, So I think that was always, it's hard to go from when you are, take the left or right, whatever you call it, is like you're taking down the big dog. That's where one of the bones of comedy is. And if you're eliminating that, it just, makes it harder to be funny unless you're in a completely different, mode. It's like, hey, I do impressions type of thing.
Well, and I really enjoy writing for that show because you could do social issues and you could do, intellectual issues. You could do politics. It wasn't really even that much on politics. Like, I think you're right. It was more social issues. Dennis was interested in a social issue, and we would pull that stuff, around it into jokes. But like, do you see anybody like I don't know what I don't know if anybody's pulled that off that is doing comedy from sort of the right or, big dog down?
No, I don't think so. I don't see it. I mean, really, I would say the closest would have been the Stephen Colbert character on The Daily Show, where it's like, half of the, if you were a Republican, it's like, yeah, I believe when it's like, well, that's a character. It's like, no, it's not. It's like, that's you. He's making fun of you. It's like, no. I would say that's the closest because it kind of played up the foibles and the faults of the right wing type of guy, and you're all kind of in on the joke. But as somebody, what's the guy from Fox,
Greg Gutman?
Gutman,
I know you're talking about Fox and Friends.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. They'll, I mean, different times people have pitched him and I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I don't see the comedy because, you know, again, making fun of the small guy in there, it's not going to work. And I don't know beyond that. And also it's, you know, you're looking for a younger audience, probably a more liberal audience. And it's like, if suddenly you're making fun of, hey, look at that poor guy. It's like, hey, wait, let's make fun of some homeless people. Yeah, who's with me? It's like, yeah, I don't know. You're going to get a lot of like, oh yeah, hey, the guy who makes fun of homeless is on. We got to go watch him now.
I've you seen know, guys that's like more, there are YouTube, you know, comedians who try that stuff, you know, and it's always just, you know, they've got the hues of stand up, you know, they've got the affectation of stand up, but then they say ugly, ugly things, and you're like, wow, yeah, you those things do not mix.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that whole world of you know, of just stereotypical comedy of making fun of minorities and things like, yeah, and then I'm sure that you know, people are still going to do those jokes, but it's not, you're not going to make a living at it. It's not going to be on anywhere. It's like, you know, the closest I guess would have been a little of Andrew Dice Clay, but it's right. A character. It's like,
yeah, as a character, you know, a caricature not, can get yeah, away with some
character. Yeah,
same way with right. Colbert, right? Could get away with that because it's a caricature.
But then he, you know, he had the shift. And well, you know, now as far as the late night, it's like, okay, that's really me. And then in talking to his head writer recently, Rich Dom, you know, when as they were developing that show, that was the big challenge was, okay, he's not doing a character anymore, he's doing him. And how do we, you know, what is the show and who is he?
Right. Know? Yeah, it's interesting, like there's a level of I've had this show idea for a while when I was still working, you know, towards the end in Hollywood about, you know, just a writer's room show, just that all the stuff that gets culled out of writer rooms, you know, that is not acceptable to say to the general human public. It's always the funniest stuff. It's the most acrid lines. It's the most, you know, to the heart of the issue, you know, that kind of stuff. Like if you were just to carve that stuff out of the room and let it out into the world, you know, what would that look like? Could people handle that, the level of real comedy writers, the way that they do social issues and, you know, interpret this stuff?
Well, I guess, I know. Yeah. It also part of it's, you know, comedy is their forbidden stuff. It's like what makes it funny is like, oh, I shouldn't be telling you this joke. And, you know, especially in a, and then you escalate that when you have, okay, a room full of people who are normally saying things that really shouldn't be told, what's their next level? It's like, right. You know, how do they get darker? And that's really what you're talking about. So, cause I've had, you know, in room jokes, where the writer's assistant who's been there goes to her home for Thanksgiving and tries one out on her family and is utterly outraged. And they just look like, what? And because it's like, well, you're desensitized. Cause why in the writer's room, everybody, you know, that's that joke plays well. And that's a go-to thing. But, you know, with grandma and grandpa and everybody visiting, yeah, I can't really, you know, no one's going to laugh at full-blown AIDS like they do at a writer's room.
Yeah. I used to have a rule of, no, you couldn't take two stand-ups to a civilian party. Like,
yeah,
it's just a bad idea to give them alcohol and two stand-ups, you know, being able to play off of each other around civilians. It quickly goes beyond, you know, into that final 7% or whatever of humor that most people just never experience. Right.
Yeah. Cause you're like, well, what? It's like, no, you can't, you know, it's like, wait, you're laughing at, wait, no, you can't say grandma's passed out. Grandpa loves it.
Well, and I remember when South Park first came out, you know, I admired that show because it was the closest thing I saw to something that went ahead and used sort of the full out comedy, you know, writer's vibe where, you know, theoretically comedy does not have a moral universe. There's no moral dictate in comedy. It's not supposed to be taken for real. So therefore you don't have, you know, the same type of, allegiance to making sure you don't, you know, really go after the sick or the weak or whatever.
Yeah, right.
There's comedy in there. It's okay to do it because the whole thing is about finding the joke. Yeah. And South Park, when it first came out, I remember some of the lines in, I think maybe the opening episode when they had a line about they're playing football and Kenny broke free. And the joke was he's running like a Jew escaping Dachau, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, oh, that sounds like stand up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh no, there. I mean, it's funny. My, when that first came out, I remember having Thanksgiving dinner and with my sister-in-law, and she had three kids. There's one, the youngest girl was five, and was like, you know, because that was supposed to be like, well, it's really for adults. It's a right. cartoon, but it's for adults. And so she, the five-year-old said to me, she goes, do you watch South Park? I go, yeah, of course. And she goes, did you see last week? I'm like, no, I didn't see last week. Because, oh, it's so funny. Chef was saying, sucky, sucky, $5, sucky, sucky, $5. And her mother's like, wait, what's this show? What are you watching? And she's five. She has no clue what it means. It was just a funny, you know, a funny term, sucky, sucky, $5. So it's like, oh, okay. I remember, and then seeing those guys, I think somewhere, you know, Matt and Trey, went talking about, yeah, well, it's really for adults. I go, yeah, well, my five-year-old niece loves the sucky, sucky $5 bit.
Well, that's because it has the right comedy. Those guys have a good ear for exactly. comedy. It doesn't matter what the content is, you know?
No, it's just a funny, you know, with a chef saying sucky, sucky is a funny thing. Well, I don't know what it means for $5. Sounds funny.
Well, and it's an easy pitch, you know, between comedy writers and people who love comedy that the culture would be better off if it would go ahead and let this stuff loose, you know, let the full comedy bombs loose, loosen everybody up a little bit. You know, but America gets so conservative so quickly on so many issues and language and everything else that it feels like, you know, there's always a constriction. You know, you'll get some of it out there for a while, like by cable and then social media, but then it hits the wrong audience and there's a constriction. And there's like, ah, I can't handle this.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, hey, you know what? Once, what was it? I remember there was a, I think there was a short-lived sitcom about the Civil War. I don't know if you remember. It was in the 90s. Yeah, and I forget, you know, it was kind of on the guise of Airplane, that type of, you know, parody that. And I remember, you know, it got some bad press. And then there was somewhere where like these politicians we're watching an episode and you watch that and you're like, okay, this is going to be horrible because it wasn't meant to be watched like this.
Right.
And of course it's, you know, offensive, but it's funny. But now, you know, you're looking at it and it's like, no, slavery is not funny. That's kind of what made it funny.
Right.
That you shouldn't be. And, but yeah, when you have politicians looking at it, you're like, what is this? It's like, yeah, I remember that got pulled right away.
Yeah, you like, can't. Yeah, that's not this, how you can't, like you said earlier, I think, like with execs, you know, you have to teach them about the comedy while they're learning to judge the comedy. And it's the same way in some ways, like with the culture, like trying to teach people that pulling comedy out of the comedy frame and dragging it over into the dramatic frame, you just can't do that. It's never going to work. You know, it doesn't have the same values.
Yeah. Right. Right. It's meant to be, you know, meant to be looked at in a certain way. You know, it's like a difference, you know, a long time ago in vaudeville, the drunk act, hilarious thing, like, oh, the drunk, and look, you know, if you say now that would never happen, but even looking back at it, you're like, oh, you know, it's like, yeah, because yeah, we understand that there's, you know, drunk driving, what they do, that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was, yeah, we all know the guy who's tipsy and, you know, Foster Brooks guy and all that. But at the time, it was acceptable. Now,
you can't watch an old movie. Like, I watched The Quiet Man recently. You can't watch an old movie without there being a drunk comic relief character.
No, there's always that guy. Yeah. This, you know, my favorite year based on a drunk guy. You know, it's like, whatever, that was acceptable. And for some reason, we, you know, then, well, I know why eventually it was like, well, no, you can't have the drunk guy in there.
Well, I remember when Chappelle brought crack, he had his crack addict, you know, character that he would do. And I remember like that sort of, you know, arresting my brain for a minute, you know, that, oh, he's going down into other subcultures and doing the same thing and pulling things up that, you know, white middle class America has not seen as a comic character ever, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, then really, that's what comedy does, is take something you know, an observation, whether it's an impression of one or a commentary of one. It's like you make fun of what you know. If you're, you know, if you're hanging around crack addicts, you're like, yeah, I see the humor in them and I see the humanity, and that's what I'm bringing out. You know, Pryor did it with his, drink, his drunk character and that, because that's what he saw.
Right.
You know, that's what he, where he, what he lived. So,
yeah. And when they go and they try to find the social value of comedy, you know, it always bugs me. They're like, well, it's teaching people about this. And so I'm like, that's not its purpose. Is it funny? You know, and that's the end of it. It can be pulled over and made to do these other things partially, but it's just about, you know, for comedians and people who have that sensibility, is there funny energy in that?
Yeah. Does it make you laugh? And it can be, as your title says, it can be persuasive. You know, as you know, that's always been that a better way than to be like shaking someone's finger. It's like, here, I'm going to show you the comedy part of this, and I'll persuade you because you're laughing at it. And that's how I get you to see, you know, whether it's an overstatement or whether a parody, and it's like, oh, I get a better view of it. Yeah, you're right. You know, now I'm able to see it in a different light.
Well, and I would like to see, like, comedy, you know, is kept over away from politics. It has its own world. Like late night, they talk about the politicians, and, you know, it's definitely fodder for over there, but it's never let into politics. You know, like the White House Correspondents' Dinner, they do a little bit. And supposedly that was, you know, when Obama did, you know, routine written for him by stand-ups or comedy writers and took shots at Trump, that was one of the triggers for Trump of, oh, I'm going to actually go into politics now.
Right.
But it's so rare that you bring real comedy over into politics. And I've made this argument for a while. Like if you just did a debate, a presidential debate, and let it be run by a couple of, you know, really good shock comics like Dave Attell or, you know, Chappelle or somebody, you would instantly know who to vote for across the board for everybody. You get more truth than politics has ever had, you know, in its entire history.
Right. Well, yeah. And although, you know, that's what it's interesting. There are some politicians who can deliver comment, like Obama was unbelievable.
He's okay, right? He could, you know.
I mean, you know what? To be able to deliver that sort of thing. McCain, you know, liked it. I wrote some stuff for him, kind of, you know, to help him a little bit.
Yeah, I remember he came to the show once, right? At CNBC.
Yeah, he came to the show. Yeah, so what happened was Mike, I was actually in Las Vegas with Mike Murphy on a little junket, you know, hanging out. And it's when McCain was, you know, thinking of running for the presidency, but everybody was like, well, what about being vice president? And so Mike said to me, he goes, you know, that really pisses McCain off. I go, it does? He goes, yeah. He goes, he has temper. And they always ask that, and he always gets mad at him. And it's like, it's not good for him. He goes, you know, need like a joke or something when they ask. And that, so I was like, why doesn't he say when they ask, hey, would you consider being vice president? He should say something like, well, I think you know my history as a POW, and I don't want to spend another 4 years in the dark.
Yeah.
And so perfect. Mike was like, oh, that's great. And so he gave it to McCain, and McCain was, you know, he used it even when he was, you know, and so he signed a book to me and, you know, Senator McCain did and things, but it was like, hey, that's a good example of take something and, you know, what would get you mad, but find a funny part to it that you can then play it off. And then people like you, because it was like, oh, he answered in a funny way. You know, everybody can do that.
Yeah. And I watched, you know, Hillary Clinton could have won that election if she could have delivered a joke, if she could have delivered a good zinger, you know, at Trump, she could have won that election. It would have changed everything.
Yeah. Because then she wouldn't have been the strident female. It's like, oh, you know what? Oh, she nailed him. And then when you do that, he's got no way to come back. Because it's like,
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if these guys use joke writers, like real joke writers. They always have somebody funny, you know, I guess on staff, but not like real sharp, you know, joke writers.
I mean, Biden, I had written some stuff for Biden for the debates. One of the guys had asked me to do that. But then, you know what? I don't know if Biden's that guy, you know, he's more the earnest guy. So we wrote a bunch of stuff where kind of more comeback type things, for him. But then you realize, like, that's not who he is. He's not going to be, you know, Obama, boom, and come back with some sort of thing. You know, it's like, you know, hey, the only bread lines when I was president were people who wanted good bread. Some, you know, and you're like, what? Oh, well, there you talk. There's, you just said there's bread lines in Trump's America, and you made a joke about it, and he can't say anything. You know that? Okay, but that's, but Biden was much more of the look. You know, we got to bring people together. I had to do that, and so to whip off some, you know,
he was the Hallmark. He went the Hallmark route.
Yeah, that's it. You're not going to get the, hey, if I want any lip from you, I'll take it off your my zipper. You know, it's like, what? Hey, it's like Joe Biden.
Yeah, I remember my first writing job in Hollywood was somebody hooked me up with Yakov Smirnoff. And he flew me down to Branson for a week to help him write on his new show that he wanted to do. He wanted to do a Broadway show. And so he just worked me like a dog the whole week. And he had gone to all these seminars and, you know, decided he was a guru and needed to, you know, tell people about life. And he'd been to a Tony Robbins seminar. And so Tony Robbins sent a film crew to get a testimonial from Yakov about how much he loved the, you know, seminar. And he's like, write me a line for this. And I'm like, okay, so it's, you know, America, like one day, you know, I'm in Russia and I'm standing in line waiting for stale bread. And then I come to America, the land of opportunity. And within a year, people are waiting in line to see me, stale comedy. And he's like, what is this stale comedy? I'm like, it's self-deprecation, man. People, it shows you've got, he goes, no, I don't do that.
Yeah. Well, no. And that's the other thing, like, you know, in this world, can you, you know, take yourself down a notch and make yourself more, you know, especially for a politician, some can do that. And they're like, oh, I don't mind, you know, making fun of my appearance or that sort of stuff. And others like, oh, I would, you know, no, I got to be strong. And, you know.
Well, and the interesting thing about Trump from a rhetorical theory perspective is he's the first guy that's like, Reagan brought dramatic entertainment, like drama. Like, he was a drama actor, and he brought that in and did his, you know, Shakespearean speeches of Cities on the Hill and all that with drama. And so he imported entertainment, dramatic forms. And Trump imported reality show entertainment. You know, he's literally just a reality show character that he heightens conflict, high stakes, constant provocation, you know, always does the villainous thing. And it has just swamped politics. Like, entertainment is way too strong for politics. Like, it just can't handle it.
No, because the audience doesn't know what's real and not real. I mean, to me, the reality, I always think of it like that, you know, they always talk about like a lobster or a frog in a pot of water, and you, and they're like, hey, this is good, but you don't realize it's getting hotter and hotter. You know, that's what in reality television was. There's a whole generation who thought reality television was the same as biography, you know, it's a, you know, a documentary. And it's like, no, that it's just the opposite. Reality is not real. And but like, how many, you know, people I know, they'll be like, oh, did you see on the Housewives they did such and such? I'm like, yeah, because there's a producer telling them. They go, there is? And like, if these eight women hate each other, but they're always going out for tea and drinks. Doesn't that ever, you know,
I do like my enemies.
The Duggars, like the Duggars, oh, you know what? They went to the dollar store. They registered at the dollar store. I go, yeah, because a producer said, hey, you know what? Well, you should, you know, like, I go, none of it's real. So when Trump came along as the billionaire genius, everyone was like, he's the billionaire genius.
Yeah.
You know, he knows what he's doing. And it's like, so yeah. And he's like, I know how to do that. I mean, that's,
he's been doing it since.
On Man and a Liar is, right? That's what I was, oh, it's.
He's been in the media. He's been a media actor for 50 years. You know him in the 70s. You know, he's been running this game, and none of the politicians can compete with that. It's not even, there's nobody even in it now. There's no other entertainers that are in the field anywhere that I can see.
Right. The only, I would say, I think, you know, again, I'd pay for a pay-per-view. I'd pay to see the Obama-Trump debate, because that, I think that's one of those ones, like a boxing in the 30s, Max Schmeling. And so it's like, oh, the, you know, it's a, because it is the perfect WWE match of, you know, it's like, okay, oh, I got to see it. You know, I'll watch that once a week. That's my WrestleMania.
Yeah. You know, at that level, and that's what it's got to become. Like, there's no way, you know, entertainment is not going to leave politics now. It's invaded, you know, that land. Yeah. They've merged. And part of my thing with doing Rhetoric Warriors is I've got all this background in entertainment, and you go into these, like, I've worked in marketing also for businesses for the last 5 years, and they have no production theory at all for their stuff. They're like, they have no production process. There's no organization. Right. Like, let's just get, you know, in a room with a bunch of executives and talk about it until we come up with something good. And I'm like, you're killing me. I said, that is never, that's not a creative process. You know?
Yeah.
And so politics, the same way, they've got, they're going to have to adjust. And maybe it's coming with like the AOC generation, you know, that are much more used to producing things for social media, at least, you know, where it's fractured that old time politics. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like I see it the other way around. Like, I saw Pete Buttigieg get pulled into old time politics. When he first got in, he talked like a human being.
Yeah.
Like, I was enjoying his interviews. And he's very smooth and he's got a lot of skill, but now he's starting to, I think he got actually, the Obama people came in and did work with him. He sounds like Obama now, like his cadence and the way, you know, the content is elevated up into that sort of glittering generality world instead of, you know, right at things. So I'm not sure anybody's really understood still in politics that, hey, you've got to be a hardcore entertainer. You need Eddie Feldman to produce your campaign.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, and I think you do, and I think that what you see happening is, and there was a while ago they were talking about it. It's like, it's, you know, it's the sound bites. But going back to Reagan, if you ever go to the Reagan Library, which is really interesting, I wasn't a big fan of Reagan, but you know, they have his speeches on cards. If you look at the speeches, there's never, the lines of the speech, the sentences are very short. That's really was the secret. It wasn't a long run-on sort of thing. It was very short, you know, maybe 10 words in each sentence that you got the point across. He could just say it in a breath. And you realize, like, oh, that was the genius of how to get this across. It wasn't like long, like a Dennis Miller rant. It was more very succinct. So the average person at home go, oh, I get that. And then on to the next one. And I think, you know, what we see now is, you know, when we see politicians on these shows is, you know, oh, I have to get my point across. I need this. I need, you know, what's the soundbite that's going to play? And that's what I think Trump did all the time was, okay, what's the abject horror that, you know, these people are going to put out there for me? So I need to get a nice short little soundbite of something that people will piss people off because that's what will get me the press.
Yeah. And like I said, he's been trained to be a villain in reality show, and that, you know, you're hitting your metal thing again there.
Oops, sorry.
That, you know, if you watch like the Housewives and, you know, all the reality shows, there's always the craziest one, you know, who causes trouble for everybody on The Bachelor or whatever. And they all hate him, but they all talk about him the whole time. And it's because they do the most heinous things. They say the most hateful things. And, you know, that is reality show entertainment. And like, if you need that person to make that show work, it's just, again, Trump broke into politics and just, it's like an invasive species to me. Like, this has never been seen in politics. You saw it kind of in the past, like with George Wallace, you know, from Alabama, did it for a while with just pure hateful racism. You know, but they can't play that card as cleanly anymore. It's got to be hidden, you know, but it's still that provocateur politician. And Trump has just been a tidal wave of it. Hopefully he's done so much of it that nobody's going to come in behind him. Whoever comes in behind him and tries to do it is going to just look weak, like a weak version of Trump.
Yeah, I don't see. I mean, you know, they talk about his kids and things, but it's like, sorry. No, you know, you're not, you know, Mussolini's kid didn't like take the cause up after that. Like, Mussolini Jr.'s here. Woo! It's like, yeah, you know, Stalin Jr. Okay, everybody. Now let's, you know, his father killed 4 million people. What's Stalin Jr. going to do? Okay, I don't know. I really want to be, I don't want to be the guy, that guy.
See? So yeah, I don't mix good entertainment with good politics. You get good comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. References that people don't know. Stalin who? Stalin.
Who?
What? But yeah, no, I agree. I don't see the next way. I think this is a, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, there's always somebody can come, but I don't see, now we're talking about Chris, you know, you see Chris Christie trying to creep back in.
Not even close.
Not going to happen.
Not even close.
There's nothing there or any, or Marco Rubio. It's like,
nah, nope.
Sorry, not you were Bannon. Yeah, none of that.
Ted Cruz, all of them, the guy, Tom Cotton from Arkansas. He's the only guy that I've seen. It's got a little bit of, he's got a little bit of pop with script and, you know, he's a little more articulate than these other guys, but there's nobody like Trump. Like they had to go into entertainment to pull him out. So they're going to have to do something like that again. Like The Rock, isn't The Rock kind of a right-wing guy?
No, actually he was for Biden, I believe.
Was he?
He campaigned for Biden. So yeah, I mean, yeah, but also we've kind of been through that WWE wrestler thing. I don't know. I mean, you know, and then you look at the talk radio guys and they're like, they're kind of dour and I don't know. I'm not sure what the next wave of uselessness and, you know, will be.
I mean, if I was producing it like from the left and I'm a lefty, you know, at my heart, just because I think it's a more fun country to live in. You know, I think it's more comedy friendly to be left than right. And I typically vote for the person that's the funniest. And like, I would just go and grab Hanks or some guy like that and just, you know, bring them over for the left and they'd do fine. Tom Hanks would do perfectly fine.
Oh yeah. You know, I mean, you know, because he would know it's kind of that Jimmy Stewart,
yeah,
you know, every man type of thing. And that might be hard, you know, especially because, you know, politics is such a cyclical sort of thing. Well, we had the ogre with Trump and
right.
It's like, how'd that work out? You know, 400,000 dead, nobody, you know, it's like, yeah, eventually, oh, all everyone's in jail. And like, yeah, you want another one of those? Nah, you know, you'd have to kind of come at it from a different set of, yeah, let nice guy for a while. And then, yeah, then until they can kind of build up like, oh, don't you hate that? So nice. Yeah, you know, nobody died. No kids in cages. You know what? You know,
that was boring.
Yeah. Well, we played they're going to take your guns when they didn't take any. What can we do? What's next?
Yeah, it does counter program itself every time. And that's partly because whatever gets to the top of the mountain then becomes the target of everything else. So they figure out how to deconstruct it and take it down. You know,
right.
When you get that many enemies firing at you, they're going to find your vulnerabilities and bring you down.
Right. Well, that's why I think they were stumped with Biden, because we're like, nothing's sticking. He's in a basement. Wait, it's like, yeah, well, there's a disease. You can't. Well, all right, but how about he wore a mask? Yeah, you're supposed to wear a mask. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
what about his son?
Yes. I'm like, what?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. When people look back and you're like, that's what friends of my people I grew up with who are Trump fans. I'm like, I just, first of all, he's completely opposite of what I grew up with, and I grew up with you. So, and then. You know, the Giuliani in front of the Four Seasons landscaping. I'm like, come on. Are you kidding
me? Come on. Yeah. It can't drop that low.
I know. It's like, that's where you're still, you know, but I think he has hit on, you know, again, the fear thing. Oh, they're going to come in your suburbs. Who? I can't tell you, but you know who. Going to come in and they're going to do this. And it's like, yeah, you know, he's played that card and it works with certain people.
Well, that's a strong thematic of American politics from all the way back. This is all Nixon, by the way. Nixon laid out all this strategy in reaction to, you know, the civil rights legislation. You know, Lyndon Johnson, when he signed it, said, well, you just lost the South for the next 100 years. And Nixon came in behind that. It's like, hey, all these people are disenfranchised from their hate. Guess what? Let's just give them a little hate here and there and we'll get them.
Yeah.
And they're still doing the same thing. It's the same.
And now we have Fox able to echo that. They never had that before, where it's like, you know, and that's what I see, you know, people say, oh, they're stupid. I'm like, no, people are just ill-informed, because where they're getting the information is really false. but they've been told that the real information is false,
right,
and to go to this place, which we know is false, but oh, we can, you know. And so, yeah, they've set that up nicely. Because once, it's funny, once you, even on Facebook, if you put some, like there was a guy that I know and he had talked about something about Facebook, and it was like, you know, well, Facebook was created to bring people together. And I was like, well, no, it was built to rate women, attractive women. And then there was this, all this other stuff, you know, that had nothing to do with bringing people together. And so I just printed that part out. It's like, somehow, wait, where did you get the, that was created that way? Because that's not the truth. And then they go away because it's like, oh, I don't know, I heard that somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's like, well, it's a mess. Like, and I'm glad that I don't work, you know, just in academics anymore. I was a professor for 2 decades. And at the end there, like the last 5 years or so, the students were just coming in so not just unprepared, but, you know, anti-prepared. You know, they not only were ignorant and misinformed, but they were antagonistic about, you know, changing that. Like they literally would turn on you as a professor. I taught at an all Presbyterian female college in North Carolina. And they,
what was that called?
Huh?
What was it called? I made a play there.
Peace College in Raleigh, Peace North Carolina. And it had been there for 140 years. It was a finishing school. It was a staging hospital during the Civil War. And it had been all female all that time because, you know, they called these all female schools in the South the Virgin Vaults because they couldn't send their, you know, their young daughters to the university where all the sex was going on. So they'd keep them over here where they were all, you know, half lesbians. And, you know, it was a lesbian paradise, all these schools. It was an interesting place, you know, but I was teaching just a cult introduction to cultural studies course and started talking about origin myths across cultures and got around to the Adam and Eve myth. And that word, I might as well have just set off, you know, a roach bomb in the middle of the room. Yeah. Myth? What do you mean? Myth? And they reported me to the, you know, president of the college who was an elder in the Presbyterian church. And we talked for a little while and he's like, yeah, you just got to be careful with how quickly you bring them through things. And I'm like, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, no. I asked because I had played a few of the all female colleges in North Carolina. I forget the names of them a couple of times.
Yeah, they're usually named after, you know, the founder who, you know, is
I forget, wasn't Farnham or Pfizer, it's what it was, but yeah, that was interesting, playing, you know, colleges like in through the South. I remember I played that one of those, like it was an hour and a half outside of Charleston, and I went there just after Hugo. And I remember driving to the college and there was a sign outside like a little mini mart. And the sign read, "We has survived Hugo." And I was like, well, this is the college I'm going to be playing at.
Yeah, so it's washed away all our grammar, but.
Yeah. We has survived.
Most of our brains have survived. Well, it's been super fun, Eddie.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think maybe we'll circle back around in a month or two and
whenever you want.
Grab some more because there's so much that you've done that I find interesting and it applies to, again, this idea of helping people basically, it's really producing their persuasion, right? You know,
right.
And once you've been through Hollywood for a while, you realize the super value and necessity of producing your messaging if you want a good outcome. And most people, again, don't have that experience with their creative or with the messages that they use in everyday life. They just say it, you know?
So. Yeah. Yeah. There's not a thought pattern like, oh, if I say this, I may get this back. If I just like, hey, let me throw it out there. You're not going to get your desired outcome.
Well, even the super value of actually having a staff of great writers and you're like, I have nothing to say here. Like, again, Tom Arnold used to call down to us and he'd want to insult Michael Irvin all the time on the show.
Uh-huh.
And because Irvin was always showing up in some kind of pajama looking, you know, fashion. And he'd be like, hey, I want to say something about Irvin. And we'd be like, yeah, well, go ahead. He's like, give me 10 lines, you know, during the commercial.
Right.
So he would just rifle through them, find his zinger, and then hit him after the commercial. And everybody's like, oh, that guy's quick. It's like, yeah, you know, as quick as the seven guys back here.
That's right. Who just get, yeah, exactly. No. And that's always the, you know, that the behind the scenes that you don't see to make the magic happen.
Yeah. So it's great to, you know, get some perspective from a guy who's done it for a long time for all that stuff. So I appreciate it very much. It's been fun.
Yep. Thanks. Yep. Okay, Dan. Good to see you.
Okay.
Happy New Year.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. We're almost done.
Almost. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Talk to you later. Bye.